creative journey. It's easy to get lost, but don't worry, you'll lift off. Sometimes you just need a creative pep talk.
Hey, you're listening to the Creative Pep Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza. The world is moving at a completely inhumane pace. We talked about that in the last episode. What hope do we have as creators, let alone as humans, of staying relevant in a time like this? They say that in order to master a new skill, it takes 10,000
hours
of practice. And I don't know about you, but that's pretty demoralizing when in a tenth of that time, most of those skills become obsolete. Like, should I learn 3D? Should I learn this new software? Like, oh, sorry, by the time you've mastered a tenth of it, it's gone and irrelevant. And it can feel pretty hopeless when that is the case. But I actually think that there is some hope. Why? Because there are skills that you can master that will never become obsolete, and they're evergreen, and they actually make you better and more efficient at learning and picking up new skills in real time. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, I bet those skills are very painful to learn. No, that's the best part. They are the easiest and most fun skills to attain, in my opinion. And in this episode, with this fun and exciting conversation I had with podcaster and journalist Guy Raz, you probably know him from the TED Radio Hour and How I Built This, and now The Great Creators, you're going to learn the first of these kind of super skills that will be the foundation of learning the rest of them. And all you have to do is listen to a story. And it's a fun story. It's an exciting story. Guy is a great storyteller, and I had a blast interviewing him. After the chat, I'm going to be back to highlight the lesson and an easy prompt to use what you've learned from this episode and use it immediately after you have listened to the show. And don't worry, the homework is also fun. All right, let's get into it. This episode is supported by In the Making, an original podcast brought to you by Adobe Express, the all-in-one content creation app included in your Creative Cloud membership. If you are trying to boost the YouTube, TikTok, Reels content side of what you're doing, one episode of In the Making that I think will be super useful to you is their episode with John Yushai. I think John's method for including his audience in the process is really inspiring. And if you want to hear about that and more about leveling up your game in the creator economy, just search In the Making in your podcast player to listen. Many thanks to In the Making and Adobe Express for their support. I really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it, got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site anyway. Go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. All right, chapter one, the essential creative lesson that Guy Raz built his creative career on. Okay, I'm going to share a dream conversation I had with podcasting legend Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour, How I Built This, and now The Great Creators, which is a new show where he interviews great creators. And yes, these are very great creators. The guest list is ridiculously inspiring. And in the research of getting ready for this chat, I found something that just made me so excited to talk shop with Guy, because we're both, as interviewers and podcasters and storytellers, deeply inspired by and guided by the hero's journey. You've probably, if you've listened to this show very long, you've probably heard me talk about the hero's journey a billion times. Well, I was pumped to talk to somebody that is as influenced by the hero's journey as I am. And I really leaned into the hero's journey in my prep of the questions for this episode. Now, there are a ton of lessons and tidbits that you could pull from Guy's creative hero's journey, but at the end, I'm going to be back. I'm going to come back with what I took as the biggest takeaway from this story and also give you a way to put it to action immediately after this episode. But before we get to that, here is Guy's personal creative hero's journey. And I had a lot of fun with it, and I think that you will as well. You've been doing storytelling and podcasting for quite some time. You're also an entrepreneur now, and I know that your parents did their own thing, but it's kind of my understanding that at least initially you thought that that gene skipped a generation. Yeah. Is that right? What, can you tell me a little bit about that, about your parents' sure. entrepreneurial yeah. spark?
Yeah, I grew up, my parents were immigrants, and so as a result of that, me and my sisters, and then eventually my younger brother, we really, and this is very common immigrant households, we did everything we could to be American, you know, in like inverted quotes, you know, going to the school dances and proms and playing the sports and trying to be everything that we could to assimilate and be quote unquote normal. And my parents really, I think, like many immigrants, saw all kinds of opportunities in the United States. And eventually they decided to start a jewelry business, to start a little shop that would sell pearls. And I was maybe 7 years old when they decided to embark on this journey. My dad was 41 at the time. So he wasn't, you know, a young startup entrepreneur. I mean, eating ramen. He already had three children. He had been an engineer by training and worked for different companies, you know, middle management. But he decided he really wanted to do something on his own. And I remember as a kid, my mom and dad, you know, just sitting with reams of like those dot matrix printouts, you know, of leads and just cold calling people and, you know, cold calling all day to just get leads to see if they could meet with people to sell their pearls that they started to import from Japan. Early on, they had to work so hard to make that business get off the ground. And, you know, I remember they would drive to downtown LA, be there all day. They'd come home late at night. My oldest sister would just kind of take care of me and my other sister. We were little. We would walk home from school. And over the years, it was a real struggle. You know, there were some years where the business did pretty good and pretty well, and some years where it really struggled. And, you know, look, ultimately, it was a triumph. My father, who's now 81 and retired, was able to raise four children on this business. It never made him rich, but it provided a living. But what I saw growing up was a lot of stress, a lot of uncertainty, and so much, you know, just uncertainty is the right word. So just so much unpredictability about what would happen year to year. Some Christmas seasons were terrible. Some were better. Some years nobody was buying pearls. They would go out of fashion. They'd go out of style. And so for me, as I grew up, I think my parents also kind of pushed this, I was looking for certainty, which I think is also common in this sort of first generation or the second generation, right, that is in the U.S., that you sort of look for something that is stable, like being a lawyer or a doctor or working for a big company. And so that was my pursuit. I was always interested in journalism, even from a young age. When I was in eighth grade, I was the student editor of the paper. When I was in high school, I was my high school editor of my high school paper. And so when I got to college, that's really what I already knew I wanted to pursue that. I was on the college paper and I became a reporter. And that was really what I thought I would do with my life. I would get a job as a reporter. I would travel the world. I would work for a big newspaper and then, you know, retire and look back on this interesting career that, of course, didn't quite pan out in exactly that way.
From the outside, I feel like it's kind of interesting that you went into journalism. It feels almost like you thought telling other people's story would be a little safer than trying to live your own story, trying to chart your own path kind of thing. But when you got into journalism, you kind of instantly hit some big struggles, right?
Well, I did. I mean, look, when I started in the late 90s, it was still to get a job at a major newspaper was so hard. You know, if you were an ambitious young reporter, you wanted to work for the Boston Globe or the Baltimore Sun or the Dallas Morning News or the Seattle Post Intelligencer or the San Francisco Chronicle, which was our, you know, of course, they were massively important and powerful regional papers. Forget about the LA Times, the New York Times, or the Washington Post. Those were virtually impossible. I couldn't even get my foot in the door at any of those places when I finished college. And in fact, I couldn't even get my foot in the door at NPR. What had happened was after three attempts at applying to NPR and three rejections, I just moved to Washington, D.C. after college. I had some friends there. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll get into politics or something like that. I got there, and the first week I got there, I got a job temping. You might remember that in the 1990s, there was a job that doesn't exist anymore called data entry. And you were hired by a company to enter text into a large computer database because they were shifting from paper to digital models. Now, of course, you just feed it into an AI or whatever if you had to, but humans were the AI, right? And a week into that job, my dad got a call on his answering machine, in Los Angeles, and it was somebody from NPR. And he didn't know what it was. And he said, "Hey, I got a message from someone at NPR." And I was like, wow. So I called. And what had happened was their intern that they had selected for All Things Considered bailed out in the last minute. And it was the fall of 1997. And so the head of the show asked for a stack of resumes, and mine happened to be, you know, the third or the fourth one down. And she was just dialing for dollars. You know, she was just dialing and leaving messages. And I was the first one that called her back, and she said, "Well, can you do a phone interview?" And I said, "Well, I'm in Washington, D.C." So I came in the next day. And I never left. I mean, I never went back to my job. I mean, talk about luck, you know, talk about a lucky break. And so I got there in the fall of 97 as an intern on All Things Considered. And that really, you know, began a career in audio and in broadcasting and a career that, you know, really was unlikely, but I loved it so much. I loved being in that environment. And it's like, you meet people who talk about the first time they drank a glass of wine and then decided to become a sommelier, or somebody who for the first time in their life they snowboarded and they decided to devote their life to it. Like, it was literally that for me. I didn't know anything about audio, but being in that environment was so powerful to me. And there was something about the creative energy that I saw all around me, the people taking reels of tape and shifting it left and right and left and right and slight left, slight right, and then cutting it with a razor blade at the right moment and watching that and learning that and sitting there learning how to make the things that I was hearing on the radio was this incredibly powerful and infectious experience, because all of a sudden, that's all I wanted to do. All I wanted to do was make beautiful audio stories. And I couldn't not do it. I couldn't work 9 to 5 and then go home and eat dinner and do other things. Like I kind of became single-minded, you know? I became this kind of single-minded person focusing on this thing. And that began really a period of about 3 years of relentlessly pursuing making it the profession of journalism. I had a hard time at NPR initially. At the time, it was very, very difficult to break in on the radio. You know, there were gatekeepers, there still are. But NPR was on the up and up at the time and eventually became a much bigger organization, even bigger than it is today, and much more important and influential. But to get on the radio was very hard. I was very good as a producer and occasionally, you know, I would get a voiceover, which I lived for. I would get to do a voiceover, or I would get a quick tape and copy, you know, where I could write a quick thing and track something that was 2 minutes long if there was a hole in a show. But generally, it was almost impossible for me to convince an editor to let me pitch a story. And so what I ended up doing was basically scamming my way into journalism, which is how oftentimes a lot of us start our careers. And the way I did that was I realized early on that I had an NPR email address, which was a huge advantage. And with that email address, I could then email other people and say, hello, I work at NPR. They didn't have to know I was an intern or a very lowly producer. All they knew is that I worked there. And so I started to email any email address I could find, which at the time was not hard to find email addresses. And I started emailing the Washington City paper at the time. And eventually, I would write, hey, I'm writing a story about whatever it was. I would just think of something. And eventually, somebody there took the bait. And I got an assignment to write an article for the Washington City paper on spec. I really wanted to be a news reporter, but the arts editor needed help. He really needed good writers. And so he had asked me for my clips. And I only had college clips, but he wanted professional clips. And I said, oh, they're in storage. I'll get them to you. But in the meantime, can I start writing on this, work on the story? And he said, great. Go. He said, are you a fan of Shakespeare? And I said, oh, absolutely. I'd seen Richard III, you know, I've seen The Taming of the Shrew, but no. He said, well, there's an actress, a local actress is in Washington, D.C., who is working. She's going to be in this play, and I was sent to interview her in her dressing room, and I was very nervous. I didn't know what I was doing. I was, you know, 23. I was terrified she would think that I was a complete fraud and that she would call me out and say, and, you know, unmask me and say, you are not a reporter. You are not a journalist. You are a fraud. You are a liar. You're coming into my dressing room pretending like you have clips, that you know what you're doing, and you're a liar, you're a fraud, and get out of here. And then I'd be found out and my career would be over. Yeah. And the reality is that that's only happening in your head. But you walk in with a pen and a pad, and all of a sudden the world opens up to you, because now I'm saying, hey, I have a job. I'm on a mission. Can I ask you some questions? So I ended up interviewing her. Her name was Suzanne Richard, and I'll never forget her name. And she was so nice. And I wrote a profile on her and I sent it to the editor, and it was on spec. It was a long profile. It was, I think, 1,100 words or 1,200 words, maybe 1,500. It was long. And he got back to me a few days later and said, well, it needs a lot of work, so I'm not sure it's going to work. But he ended up rewriting it, essentially, completely rewriting this story, and it ran. And it was a beautiful story. I mean, it was not my – it was my reporting. It wasn't my prose. But Brad McKee was his name. He's still in media today. brilliant editor, and he wrote this – he rewrote the story. I had a byline for the first time in the Washington City paper, and I remember the day it came out. It was a Wednesday. This is 1998, and I get on the metro in Washington, D.C. that night. And on a Wednesday at that time in the 90s, if you didn't get the Washington City paper by 5 p.m., you didn't get it. And you had to get it if you wanted listings. There was no Craigslist. There was no concert listings. You had to get it. And I'm on the metro and I see people reading the paper throughout the metro. That was Wednesday night. And I'm standing next to somebody reading my article. And it was the most thrilling moment in my life. It was to see my name typeset in print with this article that I hadn't really written, but I'd reported, but still it was mine. And the person next to me didn't even know that it was me who wrote it. I wanted to shake him and say, that's my article. But I just stood there. I couldn't believe it. It was a feeling of incredible accomplishment. And that was it. I mean, that was hooked. You know, I never a week did not pass for the next 3 years where I didn't have something in the Washington City paper.
I love that story, and I think it's going to resonate with my audience because I think of the listeners of the show, like me, are these people that have to create, just like you were describing, this thing of it's not enough to just do it on the side. They just want to do it as much as humanly possible, and they want those moments of sitting next to the person, you know, feeling like what they're making has some merit and meaning in other people's lives. So I think that I know everyone that listens to this show can relate to that. But then, you know, for the people that are lucky enough to get some headway in that creative journey, they find out that sometimes when you get what you wanted, it doesn't turn out how you thought it was going to, or there's just things that happen along the path that you didn't see coming. And I know there's a few different things. There's, you know, some mental health stuff. And then also at some point journalism or the atmosphere of journalism that you were part of felt stifling.
Yeah.
How did that change from this, I'm the luckiest person in the world to, I don't know if I can keep going.
I think it's important for all of us to stop and me too, because I can err on the side of pessimism and negativity. I think many of us have that gene inside of us. And I'm lucky to be married to somebody who is the opposite. She has the positivity gene. And I have to force myself to say I am the luckiest person. And being lucky doesn't mean there are going to be moments of incredible challenge and difficulty and setbacks and failure, right? But in aggregate, like, even being able to create something that you love, that you're proud of, is just a moment of great fortune, you know, great good fortune. And, you know, for me, early in my career, I was very, very lucky in that I found this thing I loved. And, you know, I spent 7 years overseas as a reporter. I ended up becoming again, starting out covering arts in Washington, D.C., which was accidental. I eventually became a foreign correspondent for NPR and became a war correspondent accidentally because I was overseas on 9/11. And all of a sudden, everybody who was overseas became a war correspondent. And many of us spent time in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And that really became my life. I covered Israel and Palestine for CNN, and that really also became my life. You know, I still was very much pursuing the idea of climbing up the greasy pole. Like, there's this phrase, the greasy pole, which a lot of people might be familiar with. It's more common in the UK, but it's famously attributed to Benjamin Disraeli, the prime minister of the 19th century prime minister of Britain, which he allegedly said when he became prime minister, I've reached the top of the greasy pole, because it's a bunch of people constantly climbing to get to the top and slipping down. And essentially, I was doing a version of that, thinking that I would do all these things. I would tick all these boxes. I would be a foreign correspondent. I would be a domestic correspondent. I would do the right fellowships. But I also really struggled a lot, even when I was, you know, seemingly very successful on the outside, with anxiety and depression. And I might have moments today where I'm not happy. But, you know, my feeling about the profession really started to shift sort of, I would say, about around 2010, really, 2011. And a couple of things happened at the time, which was I was a host of All Things Considered on NPR on the weekend. I loved it. I felt like it was the last final step to the ultimate step in the pantheon, in the Valhalla of public radio, which was to be the host of All Things Considered on Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
Because that to me felt like, well, that's where I have to get to. You know, I was the editor of my high school paper and college paper, and I got into the city paper, and I was overseas for NPR and CNN, and now I'm here. I've been doing the weekend shift for 3 years, and now I'm going to get to the main show. That's really what it was about. And what happened was I didn't get it. I wasn't – when an opportunity came up, you know, Robert Siegel was this legendary guy, and he stepped down, and Linda Wertheimer and Noah Adams. And it was when I had a chance to seek it out, which I did, I wasn't picked. And it was made clear to me at that point that I wasn't in the plans, the future plans of executives in the news division at NPR. And it was very devastating because I, at that point, had been at NPR for, I don't know, 13 years, 14 years. And it was my life. It was my identity. It was everything. And I, you know, at age 36, 37, I was done. My career, I was done. From age 22 to like 36, this is everything I'd done. And I didn't know what else I could do. I only knew how to tell stories of other people. I knew how to interview people. I knew how to make audio programs. And I started to look for other work. You know, I thought maybe I should join a nonprofit or an NGO or some organization and do something else. The other thing that happened was I stopped loving news. I stopped loving being a news journalist. You could already see in 2011, 2012, huge fissures developing in our discourse in the United States. And I didn't want to be part of that. I didn't like it. You could already start to see how people were sorting in different camps around what they felt was the truth. And it wasn't for me. I'm not a seeker of controversy. I'm not somebody who craves, you know, I know people who love being hated, and I don't. It was a time in my life where I really had to, I had two kids. I had to kind of reevaluate what I was going to do with my life, and I didn't know. And what happened was I really had this opportunity to completely shift what I was doing 180 degrees and to leave the world of news behind.
From what I gathered, just kind of looking into your story, it seemed like news also had a constraint of there was just kind of an idea at some point that you couldn't take anymore of like, you can't influence things.
No.
And that also seemed to be, you kind of got freed from that as you moved into the podcasting space. Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think many people who do creative work, right, in whatever capacity it is, ultimately it's for your own fulfillment, but it's also to have some kind of impact. It doesn't mean like you make a piece of art or you write a poem or a song and all of a sudden like you're Picasso or Siegfried Sassoon or, you know, but you might write something or make a piece of art or write a song that moves one person, which is massive. And it's the same in journalism. You know, most people who go into the profession, they want to have an impact. They want to see that their work doesn't die the next day, that it has meaning, that you profiled somebody who was unjustly imprisoned, or that you shed light on, you know, corruption, and that was resolved. And in my case, I felt – and that work does happen. But I felt that what I was doing in the news side was just delivering news every day, or, you know, every weekend. And it was hard to see that it was having much of an impact, in the sense that I always thought of news as a way to help people understand how others were thinking about the world, that they might not know or be exposed to or even agree with. And I found that the news environment by the 2010s was really fracturing in such an intense way that I was only speaking to people who already more or less wanted to hear the news from a very particular perspective. What happened when I shifted into podcasting, into the first the TED Radio Hour and then How I Built This, was that all of a sudden people were really being changed and moved in a personal way, because the stories were about the lives of people, their own experiences of solving challenges and problems, or creating new things, or coming up with new ideas. And so whether it was the TED Radio Hour or eventually How I Built This, it didn't matter that I was talking about science or philosophy on the TED Radio Hour and business on How I Built This. The premise was the same. It was people who were trying to have some kind of impact, and how they did it, and how they architected it, how they navigated their lives, how they solved problems, how they came up with creative solutions. And that we instantly began to hear from people on an individual basis about how those things moved them. And I had not experienced that at scale. I never had. As a reporter reporting to millions of people, occasionally you do a story and people are moved by it, but I'd never experienced letters, personal letters, people hugging me. That was crazy. You know, people really being moved by the stories from the interviews I was doing. And that just had a massive, profound impact on me, because I didn't know that. I didn't know what that feeling was like. I didn't know that, you know, you could tell a story about somebody's business and their experience of failure means so much to somebody who is experiencing the same thing now. To every single day, I receive these messages from people who hear How I Built This or The Great Creators, and they're like, that person did something that I know. I know that person. It's a public person. And here I am inside of their brain and their anxieties and their consciousness, and it gives me energy. And that was the difference. That was such a hugely profound difference, that I realized I could have more impact talking to people about their lives than I could delivering the news.
Yeah. And I think you might have not known what it was like to experience your work moving people or people learning from it. But I think a lot of creators relate to, there is an impulse that is longing for that. And so until you make work that does that, you don't know what it feels like. But then once you do, it's, you know, very, very satisfying. And this idea of moving people and people learning from people's stories, I'm under the impression that approach you take to How I Built This and also now The Great Creators, that you came in contact with this method in a fellowship, correct? Mm-hmm. And could you tell us a little bit about that, a little bit about what this method is and what you discovered there?
Well, I did a fellowship back in 2008. It's called the Nieman Fellowship at Harvard. And one of the really cool things that that they did, and I believe they still do it, is every fellow had to tell their life story on a Monday night and provide dinner for the other fellows. It's called a sounding, and it was just a lot of pressure. It was a really hard, like I spent, you know, 9 months prepared, 8 months, you know, preparing for mine. But it is an incredible experience, because when you sit down for an hour or 2 hours and you hear someone else's story, you can't help but feel connected to that person. And when you feel connected to that person, it completely changes the community and the environment. And so never in my life have I been a part of a group of 40 people where you walk away from the year feeling connected to every single one of them. It's very unusual. And it happened because we took the time to listen to each person's story. And so essentially, what I'm doing with How I Built This and with the great creators is taking people who we know, Graham Nash, for example, right? Graham Nash is two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee with two different bands. Most people know his work, obviously, with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And he's like at the top of his creative game. Now, he's not making music that's charting, okay? But if you ask him, and he plays it for us in the interview, if you ask him about his work and you hear his work, he knows that his writing, his prose, his ability to bend language and express words, taking all of that, you know, eight decades of life and distilling it now to new songs. He's at the top of his game. You know, I read an interview with Bono recently where he talked about how his songwriting is better than it's ever been in his entire life. And they haven't had a chart. They haven't had a hit on the charts in 20 years, probably. Yeah. You too. And it doesn't matter, because it's not about that. It's about understanding that as you hone your craft, you get better and better at it all of the time. And so through these stories, it's both this window into somebody's soul and their life that is relatable, but it's also designed to be a series of lessons of how people do things. I mean, I interviewed Stephen Colbert for this show for The Great Creators, and he talks about just the simple concept of work. And he remembered there was a poster on the wall at Northwestern where in the drama department where he went to college. And the poster said, I said, like, unrewarded talent is proverbial. And it's such a great quote, because you always – people are like, that guy just came out of nowhere and he's a superstar. Or who's that? Like, and the thing is that it doesn't exist. Like, I mean, of course, there's some people like, you know, not everybody's born to sing like Adele. But if Adele didn't hone that raw talent, she couldn't be Adele. Like, and so Colbert talks about how hard he works to do what he does to make it look easy. And I know that everyone listening to this has a version of that, you know, that I look at your artwork and it's so joyful. You know, you look at the Andy Pizza artwork, it's so joyful and it's so lovely. And we just look at it and it's this joyful moment. And the sweat, the agony, breaking through a moment to get that done, we don't know that. Because your job is to make it look easy. My job is to make How I Built This or The Great Creators sound easy, even though we put so much work into it. But it's designed ultimately with a very specific goal for you to walk out of that and say, holy shit, like somebody like Nick Kroll, who is this brilliant comedian, relies on improv, which he practices regularly, day in, day out. He works with the same group of friends that he worked with as a young improv, you know, member of an improv troupe 20 years ago, because he has to do that. It's not like you just stop and you're like, yep, I'm great. Like we had Audra McDonald on, you know, she's won more Tony Awards than any living actor in the world. And it's crazy because you talk to somebody at that level and you're like, you're Audra McDonald. You're the greatest stage actor in probably human history, okay? And she said to me, I look for roles that scare me to death. And I'm thinking, what role could possibly scare you? Like, what role could you do that would possibly intimidate you? And what you realize is that people who are committed to their craft and love it, they have fear. They have a fear because they want to make something so great. And the fact that she looks for roles that scare her tells you that if we don't have that fear, if we don't seek it out, we can't get better at what we do. That's how she gets better. She looks for roles that scare her, that force her out of her comfort zone, even though she's had 5 Tony Awards. And it's that kind, it's those kinds of stories that I think for me as a creator are just hugely inspiring. I mean, I make the show ultimately for me, it's selfishly, you know, because I'm learning from these people. But we get to share those things with, you know, with the world.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you sharing your story with me. And I've been fascinated to hear about, I've heard you talk about in that fellowship, even how story and case studies, this idea of learning through story is so essential. And you shared a bunch of little snippets of stories that you've encountered in your podcasting. And I'm excited about your show because it's essentially just a batch of creative case studies, which are found to be, yeah, moving, but also one of the greatest ways to learn. And I find, like, I think what really struck me as I kind of dove into what I could glean from your case study as a creator in your own right, I just thought it was just really moving to see how you started out refusing the entrepreneurial path of living your own story, went into journalism and told other people's stories, feeling like that is going to be, you know, a safer bet for success, only to feel like, I can't do this. And then ultimately find that case studies and other people's stories are actually the best bet you have of telling a better story yourself. And seeing that full circle moment of now, I mean, do you consider yourself an entrepreneur? You are a founder. It's just really fascinating how life pulled you all the way back there.
I mean, it is. And yeah, I am. I don't work for a big company. I haven't worked for NPR for many, many years. I still work with them a little bit. But yeah, I mean, you know, as I really began to see in the stories of others, so many things in my own life, and, you know, not like, oh, I'm just like them, but just things I could identify with, you know, anxieties or moments of self-doubt or ways that people navigated challenges, it became clear to me that that's what I could do too. And so about 10 years ago, I set up my own production company, and now I have 2. One which is built to productions, and we obviously how I built this is part of what we do, but Wisdom from the Top and our new show, The Great Creators. And then with 2 friends, we founded a kids media company called Tinkercast, and we make kids audio programs and books, and our main show is called Wow in the World, and it's a science show for kids.
I could not be more grateful for you sharing your story. I feel like if you're story was the hero's journey, the elixir that you brought back to the home of creators is this notion of the power of a case study and the power of story.
Yeah.
And I'm really pumped that someone with your tools creatively has decided to create case studies for creators, because I know a lot of creators that already have got so much from How I Built This. And so now to get it a little bit even more in our wheelhouse, it's just a big gift.
And
so thank you.
Thank you so much for saying that, Andy. I mean, that's the thing. Like I didn't mention, you alluded to it, but I took this class on that fellowship. I took a class at Harvard Business School where we had case studies, and that's how you learned about business. And I was like, wait, that's how they're learning at business school. I can do this. I tell stories. I can do it and make them available for free to anybody. And that's how I built this. We have 500 episodes now, 500 case studies of people, their lives, their stories, how they started businesses. And we're essentially doing the same thing with very famous people. I mean, Andy Garcia, one of the greatest living actors in the world, that's a case study of how does he, you know, how has he managed to, and not everybody wants to be an actor or an entrepreneur or a singer, but they all have, they're things they do, they're ways they think about the world that are universally applicable to anybody who is creative, who wants to architect or build a creative life for themselves, you know? And so you can take Jim Parsons or Zooey Deschanel or, you know, Audra McDonald or Weird Al Yankovic, any of these people on the show, Tom Hanks, and turn them into case studies for anybody to walk away from with this really, really powerful series of ideas and knowledge. And so that was the thinking behind this show. It was to say, hey, you know, there is a lot we can learn from people in the creative space, you know, in arts and musicians and actors who are paid to embody characters, to understand the psychology of them, to navigate the ups and downs of their profession. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing it. And thanks for coming on the show and sharing your case study. Everybody go check out the show. And I hope we get to talk again sometime.
Thank you, Andy. So great. Great talking with you.
Chapter 2, Embrace Meta Skills. What are meta skills? What's it all about? All right, I'm going to keep this short and sweet because we already had a big story. But here's how I interpret Guy's story. Like everyone, he needed stability and saw that his parents' entrepreneurial journey, or writing their own story, if you will, was a bit too risky for his blood. And so he chose early on to go into journalism. And, you know, it was a real job with certainty and facts, and he would find the stability and satisfaction there by telling other people's stories. But at some point, telling other people's stories just didn't seem to cut it. And in that fellowship at Harvard, he found his elixir, the quintessential Harvard Business School practice of learning by studying case studies, by studying stories of how other business people failed or succeeded. And that practice of learning from other people's stories gave him what I think he really needed, which was he found the stability and the significance that he was after in the case studies, because learning and telling other people's stories is the most effective way to tell a stable, successful story of your own. And in the end, he came full circle and became an entrepreneur just like his parents. And I was kind of diving into what is the theory behind these case studies? Like, why does the Harvard Business School use these as such a foundational piece of learning for their students? And there's a great article on Harvard Business Review titled "What the Case Study Method Really Teaches." And they go into why this method is so effective. And it's essentially this: these case studies don't teach specific skills that date. They teach instead meta skills. And even the process of just studying a case study and trying to discern from it is going to teach you these meta skills. You know, learning from case studies and stories teaches you the meta skill of things like discernment and bias recognition. So if you want to stay relevant as a creator, in my experience and in Guy's story, there is a clear, the ultimate meta skill, in my opinion, that you can embrace in your practice right now. And it is the practice of consuming and analyzing and learning from other creators' stories. Honestly, this resonates so deeply with me because this is exactly how I learned almost everything that has worked in my creative practice. And the best part is that when you're learning, and this is the best part for me because I'm ADHD and I can pretty much only do things that are fun. I don't think it should be attention deficit disorder. I think it should be like, dopamine deficit disorder or fun deficit. Like, I gotta do a lot of fun stuff for me to get a fun kick, you know? And the best part of the case study method is that when you're learning from these creative journeys, when you are studying your creative hero's journey that you're passionate about, it's fun. And so this type of learning is not only super effective in a super mega foundational meta skill, but it's also the most fun one to develop. Chapter 3, Your Creative Call to Adventure. Study a creative case study and identify the elixir. So at the top of this episode, I mentioned that Guy and I both have this big passion for hero's journey story structures and the like, and I pulled from that to do this interview. And I mentioned last week that in the coming weeks, we're going to be doing a series all about how to actually build substance into your creative practice by authentically folding yourself into the work that you make. I think it is where the inflection points happen in creative practices when they start making stuff of real substance. So how do you do that? How do you make work that is substantive? You know that Subway smell. Anyway, the best way I know how to put substance into your creative work is with the power of story. And that's why for the next weeks, we're going to dive deep into how to find your story and how to put it into your work. That's what we're going to be doing in the next series. But don't worry, I'm not just talking a memoirist here. Like, as an illustrator, when I made the Indie Rock coloring book or published a dream journal, I was telling my story in different ways. I was telling different parts of my story and what it means to be me. All of the most effective self-initiated illustration projects that I've done have been about telling my story, even when the expression was fictional or fantasy-based. And same goes for my kids' books as well. But today, for your call to adventure, your call to creative action, let's start with the step of finding your story and substance as a creator by first identifying stories that resonate at the same frequency as yours. So here's your call to adventure. Go find a guest that piques your interest in Guy's new show, The Great Creators. And trust me, it's gonna be easy because the guest list is so annoyingly inspirational. Like, as a podcaster, I have part of me is like, this is amazing. And the other part of me is like, I want to talk to Tom Hanks and Billy Porter and Andrew Bird and Bjork. And those are just like the most recent episodes. It's ridiculous. It's just a treasure trove of creative elixirs. And so go pick one of those episodes and listen to it and try to identify what is the elixir in this creator's journey. In every hero's journey, the hero is out there trying to find an elixir, trying to find something that is going to change everything for them and for their people back home, for people like them. And the elixir is the takeaway from each interview. Now, there might be a few, but what's the one for you, or what do you think it illustrates the best? What is the lesson that episode teaches you? When you get good. So not only is this good because you're going to find a creative elixir that's going to encourage you. But when you get good at seeing the elixirs in others' stories and case studies like this, your personal creative gold metal detector is going to be calibrated to notice when those takeaways, when those elixirs show up in your own life story, and those little gold creative nuggets are the best thing to build new pieces of work on. And so studying other people's stories and identifying the elixir, the secret sauce of their story, will help you start to notice your own. And it doesn't have to be Guy's podcast. We're collaborating with their show, and I'm pumped about his new show, but it doesn't have to be that. It can be anywhere. I got a serious creative nugget from Mark Maron's episode with Knives Out, Glass Onion filmmaker Ryan Johnson recently, and I'll probably talk about that on a future episode. I was so pumped about it, I had to turn the episode. I was wrapping Christmas presents. I heard it. I was so pumped about it, I had to pause it and run downstairs and tell my wife, Sophie, and then run back upstairs. But that's what happens, I feel like, when you develop a taste for creative case studies. All right. But if you want an easy fix, I'm certain there's a guest or an episode title of the Great Creators podcast that will have something that will pique your interest. And I know that Guy is such a veteran and such a masterful storyteller that I am certain that you can count on that every episode will have some sort of an elixir for you to pull from. So thank you, Guy Raz, for all your time and being such an inspiration to me as a fellow podcaster. Check out Guy's new show, The Great Creators, wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, that's it for another week. Hey, if you got something from this episode or from a different episode and you want to give back, we are partially listener supported. You can go to patreon.com/creativepeptalk and back a buck or a couple bucks or $5 an episode. It really helps us keep the lights on in our show. There's a lot of hidden costs to making a podcast, and we see you and we appreciate you. If you are in a stage in your life or creative practice where you can't afford to do that, don't do it. Like, we exist to help you level up and thrive as a creator. We don't want to be a stumbling block or a hindrance. And so if you can't afford to support the show, don't. And if you can't, but you want to give back, one thing that you can do is, there's two things you can do that really help the show. Number one, you can share the show with friends or followers. If there's an episode in particular that you found really interesting, you know, giving it some kind of co-signing testimonial film, a little video or something, you talking about the show. We've built almost our entire show that way. And we see you and we really appreciate the support. It also really helps to give Apple podcast reviews and ratings. So if you could do that, that would help a lot. Thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Massive thanks to Connor Jones of Pending Beautiful for editing the show. And gigantic thanks to Katie Chandler and Ryan Appleton. And of course, Sophie Miller for podcast assistance of all kinds. And until we speak again, stay pepped up.